Welcome to the Focus Today podcast with Perry Atkinson.
Okay, welcome back, and always a good day when we get to sit down and talk with Jim Burling. He is a Pacific Legal Foundation Vice President of Legal Affairs, and always honored to have him with us. Let me encourage you to check out their website, pacificlegal.org. They do an amazing job. They're frontline warriors there at the Supreme Court and other areas. And you can check out some of their work there at pacificlegal.org. Jim, good to see you, friend. How are you?
Hey, it's great to be with you again. I'm doing well. Thank you.
You bet. A couple quick things. 9-0 on the 14th Amendment. Were you surprised by that one?
You know, after hearing the oral argument, I thought it was either going to be 8-1 or 9-0. Look, the court doesn't want to see, and it was quite clear from the oral argument, the court, all the justices, liberals and conservatives, were very concerned about states deciding on their own whether to keep somebody off the ballot or not, based on really ambiguous language in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So I'm not surprised. I think they have also said down the road Congress could do certain things if it wants to enforce the insurrection clause of the Constitution. But I don't think Congress is likely to do that. They're going to let the election play out. And we will see on November next, later this year, who will be the next president. And I don't think Congress is going to interfere with that, and certainly not the courts in respect to keeping him out under immunity grounds.
Do you think that'll be challenged again down the road sometime?
Oh, there are always people out there that are going to challenge things. I mean, it depends. If we get a fully Democratic Congress and Senate after the election, they may try to invoke Section 3, but I don't think they're going to have the votes to do that. I think if the people speak one way, I think the Democrats are going to have to say after the last election, you should let the election play out and not try to change that through after-the-fact maneuvering. And I don't think any Republicans, those that do not like President Trump, I think they're just going to have to be quiet about this and let things proceed. We don't know who's going to win the election. It could be anybody. But we know that everybody will be on the ballot who deserves to be on the ballot.
The other surprise to me, Jim, that the Supreme Court decided to pick up President Trump's immunity case. And I did read a little bit about it. I'm not the attorney. You are. But it appears that the Trump team is saying to the Supreme Court, does a president have immunity while in office or not? They didn't say anything about January 6th. What do you think?
So we know from the Nixon case many, many years ago that a president does not have immunity for official acts under civil liability. Now the question is, does a president have immunity for criminal things that allegedly occur? And that is what the Supreme Court is going to decide. The Supreme Court will wrestle with several related issues. Number one, did the failed impeachment attempts against President Trump, won over January 6th, did they impart any immunity to the president? I think most scholars that look at that and say, no, the impeachment clause is very much different and there's no double jeopardy, no immunity issues there. And then the question is, well, what about the practical impacts of potentially holding a former president liable for acts in office? Is that going to chill the exercise of the president's authority while a president is in office? I mean, do we have to face the specter of a third world country that every time we have a new president, the old one gets indicted and thrown in jail by the new guys in office? That kind of tin pot dictatorship isn't what we have in this country. But is that what we're talking about here or not? So the court has a lot of questions to wrestle with when it takes up this case on April 25th.
There is a presumption here, which is so interesting to me. It even goes back to the argument on the 14th Amendment. There's a presumption that the former president is guilty of insurrection. He hasn't been charged. He hasn't been convicted. How does that carry over into the immunity case?
Yeah, so that's a fascinating question, because he's not being charged with immunity. He's being charged with conspiracy to obstruct He's being charged with a violation of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, of all things, which deals with destruction of records by trying to interfere with the record process. Some of the January 6th protesters have been charged similarly. But none of this is with insurrection itself. So the activities on January 6th that the Justice Department is attempting to find President Trump criminally liable for are not insurrection per se, but from all those activities surrounding what happened on January 6th, such as the attempt to stop the proceedings in Congress to ratify and certify the last election or the election in 2022. Excuse me, 2020. So that is the question before the court. Insurrection is kind of in the background, but nobody is actually, as you mentioned, charged President Trump with insurrection, because that's a really hard charge to make and to stick. And I think most legal scholars looking at that, there are some exceptions, conservative exceptions and liberal exceptions, but there are. But most legal scholars looking at that saying that he may have been doing a lot of things, but engaging in insurrection was not one of them. That's more like what happened at the Civil War, most scholars say. So I think it's a stretch for people to say, well, because of what happened on January 6th, he's guilty, and therefore it's a slam dunk. It's not a slam dunk at all.
So does Jack Smith's attempt get melted away with this?
It very well could be, because if President Trump is found to have some kind of immunity, or if in some one of the other cases going on, if he found that the there's no violation of Sarbanes-Oxley Records Destruction Act here, then Jack Smith's case is much, much more difficult to bring. It's difficult to begin with, but this would make it only that much more difficult. And if the president does have immunity for his official acts, it'll make it well nigh impossible for Jack Smith to continue. And even if the court just nibbles at the edges on the immunity issue, it's still going to be difficult.
So I, before I leave this, I guess my point to all of this, Jim, is that the case has to stay with whether or not a president has immunity while in office. That's the essence of the case. I don't know how you're going to take the prosecution of this case and keep it away from January 6th. They're going to have to weave that in. But in doing so, that's risky because the president hasn't been charged with insurrection.
Yeah. So, and they're not charging him with insurrection. They're charging him with a conspiracy to destroy records and to interfere with the governmental action, something that is short of insurrection. So they're charging him with charges that are short of insurrection, but still can carry the potential term of decades in prison.
Wow. So that's going to be argued here in a couple of weeks. I guess that'll be one of the last ones released probably in June, right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't see the court being in a hurry on that one. And unlike the unanimous decision that they just came up with as far as whether Colorado can be on the ballot, I think this question of immunity is going to split the court, and we're not going to have a unanimous decision. And I think we'll also be surprised where some of the conservatives and liberals come down on this kind of issue.
So I'm hearing you say it's a flip of a coin. It's not 6-3.
It's very well a flip of the coin. We don't know where Justice Roberts is going to come down on it. We don't know where Justice Barrett's going to come down on it. We even don't even know where Justice Kagan may come down on a case like this. Wow. It's so fraught with issues that haven't been looked at in decades since Nixon versus U.S. And times are very different than they were back in the 70s.
Give us an update of the court's, maybe an overview of the court's cases dealing with the enforcement of the Texas immigration law. What do you think?
So we just had a brief filed by Texas yesterday on this. This was SB4, the Texas law that says Texas can enforce its own immigration law, which basically says that if we apprehend a person that is in the United States without authorization, without documentation, then we can take that person and hand them over to federal authorities at the border for the federal authorities then to send that person back. So an immigration rights group and the United States has challenged the law. A federal district court said the law could stay in place. A court of appeal said, no, wait a minute, we have to decide this case. And now the Supreme Court has said, we're going to decide whether it can go into effect later this week. And it just got, as I said, the brief last night. And the issue comes down to whether or not this immigration rights group or the United States can bring this suit in the first place, because Texas is saying, well, you haven't been injured by this lawsuit. There is no injury yet because no immigrant has actually been apprehended yet. And this immigration rights group, none of their members, so far as we know, have been, nobody's been apprehended. So there's no right to bring this case in the court in the first place. And the second thing they're arguing, the United States and the immigration rights group is arguing, is that this is preempted by federal law. Federal law has occupied the entire field of immigration law, and there's no room left for any state to do anything about it. And Texas, in its brief yesterday, responded to say, no, that's not the case at all. We are enforcing state law. We are cooperating with federal law, but we are not usurping federal law in any way. And those are the issues the Supreme Court's going to decide very shortly in the next few days.
Does the 10th Amendment play into this at all?
Not particularly, because the 10th Amendment reserves to the states those things that are not occupied by the federal government. But the question here is what does the federal government have the authority to do under its Commerce Clause, under the Foreign Commerce Clause, as far as immigration, and whether Texas is interfering with that. Now, if the United States were silent on an issue, then the 10th Amendment says the state can become involved. But the federal government saying we're not silent on immigration, we've occupied the field. So that's the question. Has the federal government occupied the field of immigration so much to the point that the state government cannot get involved pursuant to the 10th Amendment and those things that the federal government has left unsaid? Texas says, no, there are aspects of federal law that are untouched by what SB 4 under Texas law is trying to do. We're trying to help the federal government, not interfere with it. We have a crisis. There's another thing Texas is saying. We have thousands and thousands of immigrants coming across the border without authorization all of the time, every day, every week. Our cities are overloaded. Yeah, we sent some up to the northern cities, but the bulk of them are down here in Texas, and we have a crisis. We have to deal with it. And the federal government hasn't helped. So it's up to us for self-help to take care of it. And the Supreme Court has a pretty tough issue before it in the next few days.
That that could cause a really fast-spinning revolving door. Let's say Texas apprehends them, hands them back to the feds, and the feds let them go again.
Yeah. Perhaps the governor of Texas is hoping to embarrass the federal government not to do that. Look, we caught these people. Let's not do catch and release. Let's do catch and send them back over the border. Perhaps Texas is just trying to make a point to say how difficult it is for them, and we have to resort to these measures. I mean, from the border barbed wire that Texas is putting down, all these things, Texas is trying to tell the administration and the rest of the nation, we got problems, and they have to be fixed.
Okay. Wow. All right. Let me take a quick break. Always an honor to have with us Jim Burling. He is the Pacific Legal Foundation Vice President of Legal Affairs. He's one of our experts on the Supreme Court. You can go to pacificlegal.org. There's a picture of their landing page and their frontline warriors on our behalf. Check it out. Support them. We'll be right back.
We'll be back to this week's interview in just a few seconds. In the meantime, we want to let you know that you can watch this interview, plus many more exclusive interviews that happen this week on the Dove's Daily TV and radio show by visiting our website, thedove.us. And while you're there, sign up for our free daily devotional, The Word for You Today. 3 months of daily readings that will connect you with God's Word. Now, back to the show.
Okay, welcome back. Jim Burling's with us today. Jim is Vice President of Legal Affairs here at the Pacific Legal Foundation. And again, let me encourage you to go to pacificlegal.org, check out what they do, and if you feel led, support them. They're really hawks on our behalf, so check it out. Jim, before I let the Texas case go, SB 4 could be implemented tomorrow?
Supreme Court decides to not to continue the injunction. The Supreme Court held it until tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. I can't remember exactly which one. Then it goes into effect. So the Supreme Court is going to decide in a hurry, based on the briefing that it's received so far, whether or not it's going to allow it to go into effect while the court's Fifth Circuit below, or perhaps it, decides the constitutionality of SB 4, or it's going to stay the enforcement, saying SB 4, you cannot go into effect. One way or the other, they're going to have to decide. So they're going to be deciding whether it goes into effect or not, and then who is going to decide whether or not the thing is constitutional or not.
So if they kick it down to the lower court, that allows Governor Abbott time to see if it works until the lower court.
Kick it down to the lower court, either allowing it to be enforced, or they'll kick it down to the lower court and saying you cannot enforce it until the constitutionality is decided. But yes, if they allow Governor Abbott to put it in place, we can see whether it works or not. We can see whether or not it interferes with federal enforcement of immigration law. And that might render the whole controversy somewhat moot. We will see.
Whatever happened to the term illegal immigrant?
Well, we could say illegal immigrant. We could say a lot of things. It's gotten so political now. The very terms you use, illegal immigrant, unlawful immigrant, undocumented immigrant, just is a litmus test of where somebody may stand on it. So I try to avoid all kinds of words to try to be a neutral expositor of the law. But we seem to be afraid of saying what's actually going on when somebody comes across the border in violation of federal law. That is somebody who is an illegal immigrant.
Amazing. A couple other things before we run out of time. What's going on with the Virginia Tech case?
So this was a fascinating case dealing with a bias response team. And universities across the country have had these bias response teams where somebody could say something as innocuous as putting on a whiteboard the word Saudi Arabia, and that is somehow to offend somebody. And people are so fragile on our campuses, almost anything can be offensive based on racial or ethnic or religious grounds. And so universities have bias response teams, which really are chilling students' First Amendment right speech. Students are afraid to say things, and if they say things, they get punished for it. So this case from Virginia Tech was going before the court. The people had asked the court to take it, and the court was seriously considering taking this case. But what happened was that Virginia Tech altered its policy and got rid of the bias response teams the way they could. And so the Supreme Court said, well, we don't have to take the case because it's moot. Virginia Tech is no longer doing that. But Justices Alito and Thomas dissented from that and said, wait a minute, just because they get rid of it today doesn't mean they couldn't put it back in place tomorrow. Besides, we have these cases all over the country where things like this are happening. And the Justices Alito and Thomas gave some examples of what's going on at Virginia Tech. I mentioned the one of Saudi Arabia. There is another time when some young male college students were observing some female college students in a snowball fight and were made comments about how unathletic those female students were in their snowball fight. And they got called up by a bias response team for saying something like that. Now, you know, it's just getting absurd. If you can't even say things, now it may have been rude, it may have been impolite, but is it something that you should be called up to account and potentially being kicked out of school for or being punished for? Holy smokes. When I was going to college, we kids would kid around all the time and call each other names and all in good fun. But we couldn't do that anymore, I guess.
Gosh, what happened to free speech?
Well, that's exactly it. We have a lot of free speeches before at the court. The free speech of social media is before the court. They got a couple cases next week they're going to be arguing whether or not the NRA can be punished through the government can punish the NRA by blocking off businesses from doing business with them. The court will decide that next week. So free speech is kind of an endangered species on a lot of college campuses and, in some degree, the rest of the United States.
I realize this doesn't go directly to the court, but it does. May show up at the court someday. And that is the immunity given to social media companies, basically censorship. Do you ever see that coming to the court?
Yeah, I see Section 230 of the Communications Act becoming really increasingly controversial. We had the two cases already from Florida and Texas that were argued already about the question of whether or not the states can force social media companies to have all comers on and not to do the censorship they did. We have that second case that's being argued next week about the U.S. government trying to censor social media companies. And social media companies are saying, well, we can't be censored. That's free speech. But they also can't be sued under Section 230 for what goes on in their platforms. And right. That seems to be a sort of a inconsistency there, a dichotomy that has to be explained sometime.
You know, someday I'll get you back. We'll talk about antitrust. But it seems to me that the government has created a monopoly with multiple social media companies by Section 230 and giving them immunity. I mean, you've taken an industry and you've given it immunity. So the industry in itself is a monopoly in comparison to us broadcasters. They have immunity. We don't.
Yeah, and that makes little sense. I mean, you recall back in the day, decades ago, broadcasters like yourself were forced to carry opposing viewpoints. Right. So if you have a Christian viewpoint, I suppose you have to have a Muslim viewpoint or an atheist viewpoint. That has essentially gone away. But you don't have the power from being sued for libel that the social media companies do. Is that fair?
No.
Of course, you don't think so.
No, the answer is no. Thank you, Jim. Thanks for your work. Thank you for your time. We do value it greatly. Let me say to our viewers and listeners, Jim and his team are on top of it. They're at the Pacific Legal Foundation. You can go to pacificlegal.org and follow a lot of the things that are going on, especially the Supreme Court. And Jim, we'll get you back on. I'm sure we got a lot of interesting things between now and the end of court in June, so we'll see what happens.
All right. Nice talking with you.
Good to see you, Jim. Thanks.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to this week's Focus Today podcast. Remember, you can visit our website to check out all the interviews we did this week on our daily Focus Today TV show at thedove.us. And if you like this podcast, please take a moment to rate us and share it with your friends.